Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Plus. And I'm so excited to welcome the program, the YouTube sensations, Jesse and Gina from Prank Versus Prank, and now they're talking about Prank Academy. Jesse and Gina, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Hi.
Good. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
That's fantastic. It seems like it's been an April Fool's prank on me, going back and forth, but we finally got you guys on the line. And what pranks are you going to be pulling today, Jesse, on a regular basis? Seems like you guys have fun doing that all the time.
I can't say what the pranks are going to be on the phone or on the radio, then everyone would know. But we just pulled an epic prank with some Major League Baseball stars from the Angels, including Mike Trout. And
the video is live right now.
And we just had, we helped him prank one of his teammates to think that he just screwed up a wedding proposal. So it was pretty epic.
Oh, wow. Now, Jesse, tell me how this started, pranking. Have you pranked all your life? Is it something just you do, go ahead and do and if for fun and then decide I'll put it on video? Tell us that story.
Yeah, I was always like a class clown in high school. I actually got like kicked out of high school for just always goofing around and pulling little pranks and stuff in school. My teachers definitely told me I would never amount to anything. And I don't know why it's saying 10 seconds is a prank.
Oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. No worries. We're going to keep recording and then it'll go live. So just got to continue.
They always said I was a bad student and got kicked out of high school, and it's just funny that I built a career after, you know, being like that in school as a prankster.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Gina, how did you get involved in this as well as a prankster?
It was all accidental. Like, Jesse dared me to eat a tablespoon of cinnamon one day, and I did it, and the video went viral. I was, like, really embarrassed that it was getting so many views. I hated the fact that people I knew were seeing the video. So I filmed a prank on him and uploaded it, and that video went viral. So it kind of created this accidental prank war between us.
Oh, wow. And so, Gina, do you have any idea how to get videos to go viral? Because that doesn't always happen.
No.
So, yeah.
It was totally by accident. We had no idea that was all going to happen.
And once you guys start pranking each other back and forth, Jesse, it's taken off, and you're like, holy cow, this is something I could do for a living. You're probably shocked, aren't you, Jesse?
Yeah, it was more fun than us thinking it was going to be a living. Like, we just did it for fun for a while. Like, we just kept going back and forth, and people are watching and commenting, and we're like, this is crazy, and it was a lot of fun. And then it just eventually morphed into me, like, wanting to understand how to edit and film properly and become a filmmaker and making, you know, higher production stuff. And, yeah, it just kind of – it was, like, by accident I found out that I'm a filmmaker from pranking.
See, I find that fantastic, and it's just like an overnight success, Gina. And now, where you guys are going from there, with your channel Prank Versus Prank doing so well, now with a YouTube original series, Prank Academy, Gina, where you're going to teach us how to prank people. I think that's so cool, and that was such a great idea, Gina. So tell us specifically the season of Prank Academy and some of the people you're going to be pranking.
So on this season of Prank Academy, we've got Steve-O, which was pretty cool. We got the Dudesons, we got a bunch of YouTubers on there, just to name a few. We have Miranda Singh, Superwoman, Harley from Epic Mealtime, Vitaly, and we're just teaching people how to pull off pranks on their friends, basically.
And Jesse, when you're starting to brainstorm how to come up with another prank, because you've done so many pranks, how do you do it, Jesse?
It's definitely getting really hard. Like, pranking Gina for, like, maybe, what has it been, 7 years we've been pranking each other? I definitely ran out of ideas to prank her, and it's really hard to prank her because, you know, everything to us is a prank now. So to think of new ideas, it was just definitely, we definitely had to help, I guess, the help of some writers. But, But it was basically just Gene and I still coming up with ideas that we always like the big. It was for like big ideas. With the Prank Academy, gave us the opportunity to pull up the real big stuff. Like I've always wanted to do something with a monster truck, or I always wanted to do something with like a car and destroy it. So these are all ideas that I used to dream of, and it was finally YouTube gave us the ability to pull these off.
And so that's the difference, Gina. We're going to see is a lot of stuff is raw when you guys do prank versus prank. Now, this is going to give you a lot more resources and a lot more opportunities and different people to be on the show that will they're fans of yours, but now they're going to get to see how you guys work behind the scenes in certain ways of coming up with this stuff, right?
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting for our viewers because they always like to see how we operate. And, like, we also have a vlog channel, which we upload a video almost every day about our lives. And everybody's so involved with like, our videos that they like to see more. And to see, like, that behind the scenes of our pranks is really interesting for them. And it's cool to share.
Are there any off-limits pranks, Jesse, you won't do? Especially telling our audience on April Fool, on April 1st. I just a little quick background. The biggest pranksters from New Jersey were the Headbangers, who I roomed with when I was a professional wrestler in down south, and they were the Chaz and Glenn, and they were absolutely pranked people from the wrestlers from the WWF, everything. And sometimes they got not hurtful, but they really liked to rip each other with unbelievable pranks. Would you say there are any off-limits pranks you would do, Jesse?
Well, I would never want to do a prank on somebody that they wouldn't laugh about afterwards, except for Gina. She's the only one I would. There is no limit for the pranks that we pull on each other. But for everybody else, yeah, I mean, I would have a limit. I would never want to prank somebody where they're just going to be angry afterwards. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just not into that. But except for Gina, because I'll feed her bugs and I have to deal with that for like a couple weeks afterwards.
So, Gina, you're the one that you guys have to go back and forth, and you do stuff because it's just like, it just becomes a back and forth. What can I do next to surprise him? Because I'm sure Jesse has his guard right even now. Right after we get off this interview, you could pull something on him, right? Especially on April 1st.
Yeah. We definitely have our guard up today.
And like we've been up really early. I'm probably going to take a nap today. So I'm like, shoot, man. I know when I try to take a nap today, it's like I'm a target. Like, I don't want to be messed with. But that's just what we signed up for this, so I'm prepared.
You might just wake up with some Sharpie drawings on your face.
No.
So how Gina, can people go ahead now? They go to YouTube. They can go right to your channel and then go out and click on, and so that they can become YouTube Red members so that they can see all of Prank Academy and all the different episodes and stuff and all the different things that are available at YouTube Red. How do they go about doing that?
Yeah, if they just go to YouTube in general, it's super simple. They could see places to just click on YouTube Red. And our first episode right now is you don't even need to be on YouTube Red to watch it. Anybody can watch it right now. So if anybody's interested in checking it out, it's right there. You can just watch it. And we actually had a stunt girl get lit on fire completely, and we fooled a YouTuber to think that he left a grill on during like a cooking show, and he thought like being that he left a grill on, this lady gets lit on fire. So it's pretty crazy. He starts freaking out.
Yeah, it was really funny.
Oh, wow. Okay, and then we never know what's going to happen next with you guys. Best place we can check you out and stuff, Gina, you have social media for yourself and Jesse, right, for people to kind of follow you and find out what's going on with you, right?
Yeah, we're both on Twitter. I'm at PhillyChick5, Jesse
Welly. And, yeah, if you just Google Prank vs. Prank or just go on YouTube, Prank vs. Prank, you can find all our stuff right there.
And your numbers, Jesse and Gina, are just unbelievable, aren't they? How many views you've had on YouTube, right?
Yeah, we have like 3.5 billion views, which is just ridiculous to say. Right now, like, holy crap, 3.5 billion, like, what the heck? I remember when we got like 500,000 on that cinnamon video, and I was like, oh, no, I remember when we got like 100 videos, and I'm like, oh, my God, 100 people just saw you eat cinnamon.
And I was so mad.
Now it's 3.5 billion. What the hell happened?
I know. You're almost getting the whole entire world that have watched you, guys. So that's fantastic. So best of luck, and I have a feeling, Jesse, you'll transition, especially like filming and stuff, that you'll probably get involved down the line in other ventures as well. I could tell at those aspirations as well. So best of luck to both of you guys, and look forward to watching Prank Academy. So take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Bye.
See ya. So, right. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. You can check me out on Twitter at Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, and also on Periscope at Total Tutor. And my guest today is going to educate me in a lot of ways. If back in my education background and this celebrity, so I'm excited to welcome the celebrity from Discovery's Bering Sea Gold's opera singing gold miner, Emily Rydell. Emily, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you got this whole story of what I'm talking about education-wise, but I'm not an opera singer or a gold miner, so you're going to educate me in many different ways. But first of all, Emily, tell me how you guys got hooked up with the show, the story of how the show started on Discovery, like that whole process.
Well, if you were either a gold miner or an opera singer, I would be impressed, or both, doing a radio show, nationally syndicated. That would all be a lot of awesome things at once. But I got my degree in music, my bachelor's degree, and wanted to go forward and get my master's, and decided to come to Nome. I had a friend up here mining, decided to come to Nome to do it, and I just happened to come here when Discovery Channel was sort of thinking about filming these crazy people who dive off the coast of the Bering Sea in Nome for gold. And it all just came together very serendipitously. I look back on it, it was a crazy time. But they'd heard about people diving in frigid water for putting gold in their sluice box on these barely floating barges, and they had to film it.
You speak about, Emily, the history of gold in Alaska, just like in different ways. I think that it's so interesting that people would not think that they're gold miners still. I mean, I can't wait to check out the show and watch it now. I mean, obviously, I would say I have five kids. I have a nationally syndicated radio show, as you said, television, plus also own a tutoring consulting company and do social media and branding. I am swamped with many things, but I always put things on DVRs. But the history of gold in Alaska has been a long time in coming, right? To find gold in Alaska, correct?
Absolutely. The gold rush, the final gold rush wasn't known in the late 1800s, actually. Started in Canada and then finally migrated all the way northwest to Nome. But it makes sense. Even though it seems weird to be a modern day, it is weird to be a modern day gold miner. It makes perfect sense. I mean, the price of gold is up in the thousands, about 1,200 last time I checked. So it's an insane price of gold, and anybody can do it. I mean, if you can find a couple of pieces of foam and a motor that sort of runs in a hose and a sluice box, you can be on your way to making a fortune for yourself. So, I mean, it's just like it was. It's always been. It's a poor man's dream, a free man's or woman's dream, and I can understand the spirit of it. That's what keeps me up here, is the spirit.
So for the number of seasons, when you first heard you were going on reality television, I know being an opera singer, that helps in a lot of ways to help you, even some PR for sure, Emily. But when you, decided, and I was kind of reading some of the background, off Wikipedia, can't believe all that and stuff, how the, there's a lot of, you have a large cast. It didn't start out that way on the show. So they go to a lot of different stories. So when you first started out, was your dad, am I correct, that also is in gold mining?
Yeah, my dad and I actually came up here together. Our family friend, a guy that I grew up with, Zeke, was up here mining a couple of years prior, and he invited everybody that he knew to try to come gold mining in Nome, because I guess he hated them or something. No, it's kidding. So my dad and I came up together, and we sort of got into the business totally green together, and there are different crews featured on the show. It's been a revolving door for some, and then some have been here since, myself included, we've been here since the very beginning with the show. And it just seemed, I mean, reality television is this is this reality, as it were, in Alaska.
Right.
I mean, everybody you know is on it. Or you're related to them by the third degree. And it just seems inevitable that Discovery Channel cameras would be up here filming you do crazy stuff. I mean, it's unavoidable, practically. I mean, there's a camera behind every door in Alaska.
It definitely seems like that there is, for sure. And so the process, what did you feel like when you've seen the seasons happen and stuff, and you're out there mining gold? I mean, people probably in Alaska talking to you, but also when you're traveling the country or different things, what are their questions, especially a woman mining gold? What have you heard? What kind of questions do you get asked?
Well, mostly what's it like to be a woman mining gold? But, you know, it a lot of it relates to how television it changes things after the fact or during the fact, you know, like how present are they? How much do they manipulate and interfere with the story of what's really happening and how much of what we see is true? And I would say that this would not be something that I'd be comfortable doing if I felt that they were controlling the script. You know, it is something that I like doing because it feels genuine. Even if, you know, it's like what they do after they get the footage is their business. But what they do when they're here and known with me is my business. And so I like to just be myself, be honest. I try not to watch the show too much. Not that it's not a fantastic show and you should definitely watch it. But moreover, just so I can retain a sense of who I am versus what Discovery Channel's Emily Riddell is, if that makes sense.
Well, that definitely makes complete sense. So what should we expect this season? Especially, again, the season premieres tonight, March 30th at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Discovery Channel. What should we expect this season compared to other seasons?
Well,
anything?
You know, I think this season is unique from, I mean, this is the fifth season of Bering Sea Gold. So, I mean, it's a show about gold mining in the Bering Sea. And that doesn't really, you know, differ from that theme, general theme. But I think that the ways that people are mining onshore and offshore and onshore, by the way, this season, I think the way and the method that people are attempting to recover this precious metal is rapidly evolving, and that's what's interesting about this season. I mean, the means that people are going to, the cast of Bering Sea Gold is going to, the desperation and the things that we are trying to, in order to have more success, in order to generate more wealth for ourselves, that's definitely something that's new.
Interesting. So things keep getting better for you. So you have a bunch of gold bricks right in your backyard. I mean, right in your house, right? No, or you're going to the bank a lot.
No, I just have this big gold chain. I just wear it around me everywhere I go. You know, it's pretty impressive.
Hey, that makes me
no,
good.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Emily, where's the best place we can connect with you? What's the best place we can connect with you? A website, social media, anything we can connect to find out more info on you?
I don't know. Maybe I should talk to you about managing some of that stuff because I'm pretty bad at it. I'm Facebook. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all of that stuff. I'm kind of an Alaskan about it, but I really do try hard to interact with fans on those platforms.
Social media is a tough thing for lots of people. They think they get it, yet they don't. So definitely reach out to me if you want to talk to me. I'm happy to have a convo with you. But good talking to you. I'm going to tune in tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Bering Sea Gold on Discovery Channel. Thanks again for calling, Emily. Take care.
All right, I'll be calling you about that. All right, thanks.
Okay, you can find me. You can Google me and you'll find me. All right, take care now. See ya.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right, you're listening. Goodbye. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net for more information, Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google+, and also on Periscope at Total Tutor. And I'm excited first to welcome the program my co-host for the Just Two Choices Celebrity segment, Rico Rakowski. Rico, how are you? And when I talk to about our guest, he might not consider himself a celebrity, but I do with his honors and his accomplishments. It's just an amazing guest.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And hi, Vice, to you, Neil. And today's guest is astronaut Kevin Chilton, call sign Chili. So if you hear Chili come up in the conversation today, we're talking to Kevin. And he has one of the most amazing backgrounds in aviation as an RF-4 pilot, flew F-15s, as a fighter pilot, test pilot, and in space. Got about 30 days in space all and on three shuttle missions. And also as the commander for the Air Force's Space Command, the Strategic Air Command. So you can kind of say, you know, he's the guy, he's got all the right stuff. You know, Air Force Academy grad, astronaut, test pilot, fighter pilot, four-star general, astronaut Hall of Fame.
And in his spare time. No, I was saying, and four-star general. We don't get the many times to talk to a four-star general, that's for sure.
Nor a four-star general who also, in his spare time, hammers out riffs on his Fender Stratocaster. So there, I think that's a really rare breed right there. Kevin, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Rico, Neil, it's my pleasure. So good to hear your voice.
Oh, yeah. Go, Rico.
No, go ahead, Neil.
No, I was just saying I'm excited to talk. And, Rico, I guess you guys are really go back a long way, you and Kevin?
Yeah, we went to the same college. We went to the Air Force Academy, and Kevin's, of course, gone up into the stars there, so it's fabulous. And, you know, which is an interesting thing, you know, I was talking to Kevin the other day, and, you know, sometimes in things in life, and it goes for yourself, too, you know, you're in professional wrestling, and here you are an educator. You know, many of us discover that what we started out doing is an entry point, you know, it's only an entry point into something that gets even bigger and better than we ever could have imagined. And Kevin talked about how he was just interested in being an airline pilot. Kevin, could you kind of give us that little bit of a background in terms of you're just interested in flying and being an airline pilot, and, you know, the rest of this unfolds all the way through test pilot and astronaut and four-star general. Can you kind of give us that little bit of a background there?
Yeah, happy to, Rico. It's, you know, what turned into a career certainly wasn't planned. And as you said, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles in the shadow of L.A. International Airport. And my mother had been an airline stewardess in the 1940s. Her very best friends in life were former stewardesses. And one of them was married to a gentleman who we called them aunt and uncle, even though they weren't. They were just such close family friends. He flew for United Airlines. And he seemed to really like what he was doing. And, you know, my grammar school was at the approach ends of LAX, and my high school was at the departure. In fact, we used to joke we could read lips because every 2 minutes a jet would go by and make it hard to hear the teacher. I spent a lot of time looking out the window. I was watching airplanes fly, and I just thought it was magical. And my father was an aeronautical engineer, so I said, you know, I think what I'd really like to do when I grow up is be an airline pilot. But the problem was learning how to fly. And I'd read it. One of my uncles gave me a book called Anyone Can Fly, and I read it. And said, go down to your local airport, wash airplanes, and push them around, and do maintenance, and trade. Don't do it for money. Trade it for flying time. And, you know, I may not have been the sharpest pencil in the box, but I knew that wasn't going to work at L.A. International Airport.
No.
So I just, I was kind of flummoxed. I think I was about 12 years old. And one summer day, what we used to do in the summer is we'd call our buddies up on the phone and say, do you want to play baseball, football, or can your mom drive to the beach? You know, we all really wanted to go to the beach every day. One day a friend said, Bill Toomey, said, nah, my mom can't drive, but my brother's home from college. If you can get over here in 10 minutes, we're leaving for Manhattan Beach. We said, okay, I asked my mom, jumped on my bicycle, rode over there, and jumped in the Toomey station wagon. It was a great family of seven boys, and off we were heading to the beach, and I turned to Bill, and I said, well, what's your brother's name? He said, it's Dan. I said, hey, Dan, where do you go to college? He said, I go to the Air Force Academy. And I said, what's that? You know, so it's kind of providential there, you know.
Yeah.
I used to say, it's a school in Colorado. You go there, you get a degree, and then they teach you how to fly it. We fly jets for the Air Force. I said, well, gee, Dan, how long do you got to do that for? And he said, well, 5 years, which was the commitment in those days. And I said, could you be an airline pilot after that? He said, yes. I said, okay. And that day, sitting in the back seat of the Toomey Mobile, I decided I was going to go to the Air Force Academy or try and learn how to fly and then become an airline pilot. So everything else kind of fell into place after that. But that was, you know, being an astronaut was not on my radar screen, and certainly not making a career out of the Air Force.
Wow.
And Kevin,
Dan changed my life.
Yeah.
That young man, Dan, changed my life.
Wow.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Answering my silly questions. Yeah.
When you were interested in flying planes, when you first looked at this, what kind of struck you to say, I want to do this? What was that moment as a child or an adolescent or even a little older as a teenager where you said, I really want to fly planes? What kind of influence was that made you really want to do this?
Well, Neil, I think it was a couple things. For me, even to this day, even though I've had plenty of aeronautical engineering training and I'm an engineer, when I see an airplane fly, take off or land, to me, it is still magical.
Yes.
When you see something created by man, that's this big, huge device made out of metal that's carrying people on board, gracefully lift off the ground and climb off into the sky, I have that feeling that it's just magic. You know, I understand the math behind it. And then I'd say the other thing was that uncle of mine, who, you know, wasn't a blood uncle, but certainly felt that way family-wise, Uncle Milton Smith was his name, and the United Airlines pilot. When his son Jeff turned 12, he bought Jeff a $5 orientation ride in a Cessna 172, and he'd bring a friend along. Well, he called me up, and that was my first flight in a light airplane. And it was everything I had ever imagined flying to be, and even better, you know, be up in the sky and looking down. We took off from Torrance Airport in Southern California, flew around, flew out over in the channel between Catalina and the Palos Verdes Peninsula and around and over Long Beach back in. It was about an hour-long flight, and I was just so thrilled. I remember we landed, and the instructor pilot who had taken us up, we were taxiing in, and I looked at him, and I asked him, do they pay you to do this? He laughed, and he said, yeah, this is my job. And I thought to myself, I can't imagine having a job where they paid you to have this much fun. And so, Neil, I'd say it was those two things, just being exposed to the airplanes there, taking off from the airport all the time, and then that first flight.
And
you know, there's also been things tied to
that's interesting that those experiences, Rico, lead to exploring more, Rico, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, you know, there's plenty of stories of the pilots have from being in the classroom and looking out the window and, you know, and teachers making comments like, you know, you're never going to find a job looking out the window. You know, you just put your head back in this classroom and pay attention to what's going on in school. And your pilots sometimes make the comment, you know, so mesmerized with aviation. You know, I wrote that teacher and told her, hey, I found a job looking out where I get paid to look out the window all day. You know, it's being a pilot. And so it's surreal. I still get super, you know, just very excited about it. Every day is a new day. Every flight's a new flight. And you know, speaking of those kind of mesmerizing and surreal things, just fast forward a little bit. In comparing those two, you know, to based on Neil's question, what's the difference in your feelings, you know, being up in space? I mean, I'm sure it's indescribable. The first time you're in space, and then even the third time you're in space, I imagine it's probably all just exhilarating. Can you compare the two, or are they uncomparable?
You know, I think there are a lot of comparisons, Rico. Having the great blessing to be able to fly on the space shuttle and be a part of the NASA family and team and the crews I flew with, and to be able to look down on the planet from those altitudes and its speeds. And, I mean, just what a gift. But the emotions that are stirred in your heart and your soul by that are not so different from the emotions you have when you see a beautiful sunrise and you're just awestruck by it, or a beautiful sunset, or you're flying on a starlit night and you kind of take in the vastness of the universe, or the day that you hold your firstborn in your arms, They're very, very similar emotions that are just give you such great pause, such great gratitude, and awe. Actually, just you're awestruck by it. So it's just a different environment that you're in and experiencing that. And it was very, very special. I don't mean to belittle that, but the feeling that you have inside you is one that I hope that just most people have experienced, just not in that venue.
Wow.
I was talking to Rico about how he's considered a rock star to many different people because he's just an airplane. He's an airplane pilot, and how many people wish they could fly planes, or you know, especially a fighter pilot. Now, for you, Kevin, you have something that's on everyone's laundry list when they're 5 years old, especially boys that they want to be astronauts. So, once you tell people that you are an astronaut, what are their responses to you? How do they respond to you in that conversation? How it just somehow comes up? It's got to be like everyone's eyes light up and they're just so interested and amazed to hear the story, right?
Well, you know, usually I don't tell people that I was an astronaut and I'm happier. But if they do discover it, you know, what's that? No one was more shocked than my father. Which is not true. You want that? He's so proud of me, and I love the fact that he's proud of me, and I love him. But no, you know, there is. It's kind of when they do discover it, or the conversation ends up there. It's kind of, well, first they're shocked. They can't imagine that they met somebody that had that opportunity, and then they want to know what it was like. And although I don't talk about it and offer it up front, I will talk until the cows come in about aviation, flying, and space flight, because I love talking about it and answering questions.
Great.
That's fascinating. You mentioned that, Kevin, because you know, like Herb Kelleher, the founder of Southwest Airlines, if you didn't, he just comes up and says to you, "Hi, I'm Herb." You know, he doesn't tell you he started Southwest Airlines, you know, unless you ask. Roger Staubach, we had the blessing to interview him, and you know, he's of a very similar philosophy too. He's just, you know, he's blessed that, you know, he feels blessed that it came out that way, that it worked out so well for him.
Yeah, you know, and I agree, and when I meet somebody, I'm more interested in them. I know my story, and it's kind of boring up here.
I wouldn't say that, Kevin. I have about 1,000 different questions, but Rico's so detailed in his questions. I'm just looking forward to the follow-up. I mean, it's an amazing thing, Kevin.
Everybody has a story. You just got to ask. Everybody has a story.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you string the story together, now I'm going to go into some technical stuff. Just to shift gears into space and the mindset that it takes in aviation, you know, in terms of the choices you have to be on top of, you know, from step to step. It's not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, staying in that flow and being able to manage all of those switches and how all that information integrates in terms of where you are and what you want to do. You know, back in the 60s, the space program, you know, progressed through Mercury and Gemini and onto Apollo. And, you know, everything got complete, you know, it's more complex. And as things got more complex, as you know, with like Gene Kranz and, you know, failure is not an option. Those people who are mission controllers developed these things, you know, those mission rules books. And so I've read about them. You know, they seem to, the way the guidance takes you to, guide you through all these different problems where there are going to be two clear choices, either go or no go. You're going to continue or you're going to abort. Can you give us a little bit of an inside view to the significance of that go, no go strategy and the mission rules books, because, you know, how they've evolved over the years and how much you as an individual while you're up in space, as say the commander of Atlantis that you were, you know, on that particular shuttle, are thinking about mission rules and how go, no go is part of your logic process. Could you share with that?
Sure. Yeah, and the mission rules, or they were often called flight rules, were hammered out over long periods of time in simulation, or just flat people sitting down and thinking, putting thought to what could and couldn't go wrong, what was essential to continue, what was safe, what were if something had gone wrong, what were the alternatives that could that allow you to continue or not continue, or force you to make a decision not to go. But, you know, they tried to boil it all down to as simple as possible, but that didn't mean it wasn't complex. But in particular, in crisis or in, if you imagine in a launch countdown, you're time constrained. I mean, there's a launch window. There's a lot of things that have to come together that, when they do come together, aren't going to stay together for a very long period of time based on extreme temperatures, et cetera, the chemicals and liquids that are being used. And there's not a lot of time for just sitting around. You schedule the launch time. You want to go off on time, and there's a reason for that. And so you have to, and they did, develop a very disciplined approach to polling everybody that had an insight into critical elements of the rocket on go, no-go. And it was a formal, very formal poll right at a certain time as you approached the launch time and going around the room, and each specialist would give a go, no-go decision. And it was a serious, serious moment. And when they said go, the leader, the flight director, the Gene Kranz in the room, which there's been many, many to follow, trusts that individual, trusts everything about that decision, doesn't question it. And it's really, I had a great opportunity, great privilege to work in mission control as a CAPCOM or capsule communicator for several years. And that was always a thrilling, intense moment when the flight director pulled the room for a critical decision.
Now, I'm going to talk about Kevin. You already were an airplane pilot. To go from that pilot to an astronaut, were you fearful at all? Because, there are tragedies that happen when you get in the space shuttle. You know that it's not always going to go as it's planned. Do you have any butterflies and nerves of going in a space shuttle and flying into space?
Certainly. I think I probably shared a fear that most astronauts would tell you that we had. I mean, look, my first flight was post-Challenger, so everybody knew what was at stake. And it wasn't just you that knew, your family, your mother and father, everybody knew what was at stake. And that part, was actually something you had to come to grips with to even be an astronaut, A. But once you decided to do that, you kind of worked your way through it. And, I can tell you, when by launch day, that was the last thing on my mind. The thing that you feared most, though, I did anyway, was that I would make a mistake that would either impact the outcome of the mission or put my crewmates at risk, their lives at risk.
Right.
And there were certainly many, many opportunities to do that. And so you trained so very, very hard to be as perfect as you could be in the normal flow of things, and to be also as perfect in your judgment and decisions and switch throws you would have to make in a anomalous situation where those switch throws could be the difference between, success failure or life and death. And your biggest fear was that you wouldn't personally be up to the task to accomplish that successfully. There was no, ultimately, on launch day or the moment of launch, that was the predominant fear that I would say I had. I mean, on every flight, after getting strapped in, I fell asleep, took a nap. That's how sanguine and fatalistic I was with regard to my personal life, my life. But you're pretty focused on trying to be really good at what you were chartered to do.
If I could add to that, Kevin and Neil, for the background, it happens that way in aviation. I mean, even when you're flying and you're a flight lead, to say a four ship of F-15s or 16s or whatever you're flying in,
okay,
tactically, you're the guy that's responsible for the whole flight, and so that's that thought process is a part of aviation in general, and in the airlines too. When you're flying, it's about the 100 and something or 200 something people that are on the airplane that you're thinking about, that, you want to make sure that you do just like Kevin was saying. It's a normal, it's a normal concern, I would say, is to say, you want to be as prepared as you can so that if something does go awry, you know, you're able you know, correct it. So.
Yeah, I agree. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. That fear is something that is common to aviation, and no different than the shuttle.
No different than the shuttle. Nicely said. I understand what you're saying. Wow. Now, when you're up, we had talked earlier, Kevin, and we were talking about, I call these things choice moments. Of course, every moment's a choice moment. And, you know, you were talking about your career, and it reminded me of something that happened in high school for myself. I had a choice moment where a guidance counselor suggested, actually told me to go to junior college and not to, you know, not to be getting into aviation. And I wasn't upset by it. I just kind of thought about it and said, well, to myself. I didn't say it out loud. I said, no, that doesn't sound right. So I had just two choices, believe her and or believe somebody else, which we all have those options in our lives, to believe somebody else or to, you know, follow our dream or our vision. And so could you tell us about a couple of key points that as you're navigating through the Air Force, I think you had like three or four of them, where people told you, they suggested that you not go a particular direction, and you say, well, I'm going to go ahead and go that other direction anyway. Can you kind of describe a couple of those choice moments and how, obviously, where you are, and it went contrary, but can you kind of describe for our audience those things, a couple of those choice moments?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. You know, I think the background would have to be, you know, I'm not proud of this. The only reason I went into the Air Force Academy was for some very selfish reasons. That was strictly a way for me to become what I wanted to become at the time. I thought an airline pilot. And so in that context, you know, I was always, you know, I was going to serve my commitment, do my duty, be professional, but I was looking at that five-year point after flight school when I would get out. And so probably some of the early choices were, well, why the heck did you stay in? I mean, I could have gotten out several times along the way. And each time I thought about that, it was a choice, yes or no. And I can distinctly remember at some point along the way, I was attending my Uncle Milton's retirement party and from United Airlines. And everybody there knew each other except me. I was the odd duck. I was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base at the time, flying at student and test pilot school. And I'd driven down to Palos Verdes to his home and met all these United Airlines pilots. And they were great guys, but every one of them, they asked me, well, what do you do? I said, I'm in the Air Force. Their first question was, well, when can you get out? And I said, well, I can get out now. You know, I had no commitment. I'd served my commitment up. And they said, just about all of them said, well, now's a perfect time to get out. United's hiring. It's a great time to get into the airline industry now. Oh. And one individual went so far as to say you'd be a fool not to get out. Well, that night I had to drive from Palos Verdes back out to the high deserts of California to Edwards, about a two-hour drive, and it was a dark night. I'm in the car by myself, and I'm thinking, am I a fool? Because I don't feel compelled to get out. And it was that night I decided that I'm going to stay in the Air Force until I'm unhappy staying in the Air Force. And I have been happy, I realized all along, and that this choice to get out, yes or no, I made that evening to stay a little longer. And it wasn't, you know, a forever choice. It turned out to be. But that was probably an interesting one. And then I think a couple other ones we talked about, Rico, when I went to apply to be a test pilot, and that meant I was leaving the fighter community, and I was counseled that it wasn't a good career move, and I appreciated the counsel. In every case, the people who counseled me not to go one way or another, they had nothing but the best interest, my best interest in mind. I always felt, but I said, no, this is something I'd really like to try to do. And then as a test pilot, when I applied to be an astronaut, I was counseled, was, you know, throwing away a perfectly good Air Force career to go do that. And I appreciated that counsel, but I just felt like I wanted to go try something different at the time. And then finally, when I was after being at NASA for 11 years, the opportunity to return to the Air Force was presented to me. And my boss at NASA counseled me, said, don't go back to the Air Force. you have a future here, and that's
what I
really would like to. And so, you know, went back to the Air Force and completed 13 more years in the Air Force, which I didn't know that was going to happen. There were no promises. It was just something I thought I wanted to do. And, well, at that point, my wife and I thought we wanted to do it with a family decision. So those are yes and no. Those are certainly forks in the road in my career, Rico, that I didn't take lightly those decisions. I didn't take the counsel lightly.
Right, right.
I appreciated the counsel, and I thought prayerfully and in collaboration with wife after, you know, at the points in our lives where it was not just a decision impacting me, it was impacting our family, and they were not off the top of the head kinds of things, but it turned out to work out pretty good at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, you think about the other thing that we haven't really introduced. We're all into the astronaut and pilot, but four-star general. I've spoken to one general before on my show. You're the second. And do a lot of people address you as general, I'm sure, all the time. So General Chilton, how did you get to the point to rise to four-star general, especially when you went to NASA for a bit, too, and then back to the Air Force? Just, again, great honor to be able to get to that level of rank, isn't it?
Yeah, the great honor is to be able to continue to serve. And
right.
the military is kind of, it has an up or out structure. So at some point, we all get promoted to a certain level, and then we have to move on to something else. And the promotions that followed after our return to the Air Force were all a gift to me, an opportunity for me to continue to serve is the way I look at them, and I was always humbled by them. You don't achieve anything in life without the help of a lot of people. I've always credited any success I've had to two things that, you know, and my parents taught them to me. You know, it doesn't matter what your job is, it really doesn't matter in life. You all can end up in the same place eventually. What matters is that you give it your best effort, you know. And, you know, as a good friend of mine said, you know, the key to success in life is to show up on time in the right uniform with a good attitude and then work hard, whatever it is the job at hand is. And I firmly believe that. But the other thing, I think, you know, just as self-assessment, I think if nothing else, I've proven over and over again, I'm eminently trainable. So even if I don't know what I'm doing, I'm a good listener and a good student, and I'm eager always to learn new and different things. And those have helped me along the way as individual personality traits. But lastly, and far more importantly, is I worked for some tremendous leaders who took chances on me, who gave me opportunities to fail, which also means they gave me opportunities to succeed.
Right.
And these men were exceptional Air Force leaders, and you know, without them taking a risk, you know, career risk for them, even to, you know, give me jobs that I might not do well at. Without their faith in me, I never would have been able to stay in the Air Force as long as I was blessed to be able to.
Rico, we're at that point. We're at that point. The final question. And now this is where Rico has an amazing survey of amazing guests we've had on this program, from a variety of head football coaches to Hall of Famers to NFL, NBA legends, all these different variety of people, famed authors have answered this question. So, Rico, go ahead and ask this question.
No pressure here. Huh?
I had to do that to you. I mean, I at least had to put that. You're on the hot seat. So, okay. Good.
Well, we can't see if you're smiling or not, Kevin. So, I am. No, we can't see if you're sweating or not. But the question is, it's a real general thing. It's actually a philosophical question. You know, what percentage, as we talked about with regard to choice, you know, what percentage, when you look back at life, what percentage of life do you feel is choice, and what percentage do you believe it's circumstance? We've had 80-20, 90-10, 60-40. We have 100%. We've had all those answers. But from your experience in life and all the phenomenal things you've done, what's your answer to that in percentages, since you're a
very scientific guy.
Well, every day is a different circumstance.
And some people are presented more than other, you know, opportunities, mm-hmm. you might say. But, you know, but at the end of the day, it's choices. You know, you choose whether you're going to take advantage of the circumstance that you're in. So, you say, this is a percentage of becoming a four-star general. There's so much luck involved in that. So I put that 100% circumstance, you know. But for leading a fulfilling life, it's 100% choice.
Yeah.
100% choice. Every day you get to choose good from evil, right from wrong, better from slightly better. And you get to make those choices every day, dozens of times a day, and they really can impact not only your life, your family's life, and your happiness. And so it's both.
And I agree in the kind of that you look at circumstance in life is something that is everything. But it's choice, and a lot of people could have all the decks stacked against them, and they work really hard and they achieve what they can achieve based on their ability, but they made the choices to either succeed some or not succeed at all. So even if the deck is against you, you have to make choices to move forward, or else the choice is that I choose not to be to work hard. Hey, there you go. You're not going to be a four-star general, or you're not going to be an astronaut, or you're not going to be a fighter pilot and a pilot. So
Or you're not going to be landing on the moon. You know, it's just go. There wasn't a no-go, so they just kept going, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, I heard someone say once, one of the greatest lies, and I'm guilty of it, that we tell our children, is that you can be anything you want to be. You know, and then I said, look, you know, Mother Teresa, no matter how much she wanted to be a professional basketball player, could never be a professional basketball player.
Right, right.
She had certain talents.
Yes.
Right? She had certain talents. But she utilized those talents. She made choices to utilize those talents in the most beautiful way. And so each one of us has a certain God-given set of talents. We are placed in various circumstances that oftentimes we have no control over, oftentimes we do. But at the end of the day, it's about the choices we make. And those choices oftentimes can open some pretty amazing doors for us, regardless of the talents that we have.
And it's that when you in your mind you believe you can't do something, then it's over. And that's the whole process in this, is that the choices we make will lead us to where we are led, but it's based on our thought process and what we think we could do. Yes, not everyone could be a superstar basketball player or an astronaut, but your gifts and talents will lead you to the right thing. So, Kevin, you have no places to follow you, right? We can't follow you anywhere, right? No Facebook, anything for people to connect or email you or ask questions?
No, I'm kind of off the net in that regard.
I had a feeling.
Well, you know, when I was the commander of STRATCOM, I was in charge of the one of our missions there at STRATCOM was cybersecurity. So
I don't think
you won't. Given what I learned in that job, you won't find me out there in the ether.
All right. Well, sounds good, guys. Thanks for being on the show, both of you. A great show again. Just2choices.com for more information on Rico, or follow him at Just2choices. Take care, guys. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, see you. Okay, bye-bye.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can check me out on Twitter at Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley Facebook, LinkedIn Neil Haley, Instagram Total Tutor, Pinterest Neil Haley, Google Plus, and also on Periscope at Total Tutor. And this actor, you'll remember him from so many different things, but this series is really excited. I know he's excited to talk about it. I'm excited to welcome the program celebrity Titus Welliver, star of Amazon's original series, Bosch. Titus, thanks for calling in. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Good morning.
Fantastic. Good morning to you too, Titus. And I know you're pumped for season two, aren't you? The launch of season two.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. It's, you know, we come back after a 6-month suspension I think the audience assumes that perhaps it's mellowed Harry, but we find out very quickly that, like all good fine wine, it's a slow process, and I think Harry in that way is the original slow learner. He's not going to change his stripes. So out of the box, Harry is right back to being Harry.
Interesting, Titus. Once you first learned about auditioning for this and taking the role on as Harry Bosch, what did you think of it when you first read the script and, you know, took a look at everything and what that character was like?
It was a very, very quick decision. I mean, the script was so well crafted, and the character, you know, I mean, it's kind of a dream role for any actor. He's, you know, a very multi-layered, complex character. He's a guy who has a flawless moral compass, but is not this sort of, just straightforward hero character. He's a real anti-hero, and that makes him very, very human. And a lot of interesting stuff to play there. So I read the script, and in fact, I mean, the thing about it was that I didn't really want it too much, because that's sort of the actor's curse, is you read something and fall in love with it, and you want to do it, and they say, well, that'd be great, but you know, Robert De Niro and Bruce Willis are in the running for it, and you go, great, thanks. Please don't send me any more scripts that huge movie stars are in contention for, because it just breaks my heart. So this ultimately worked out pretty damn well.
It definitely did work out, Titus, and, you know, working with so many amazing actors and actresses in your career, you're right. You, as a working actor, you say, they're going to have someone else get this. So once you find out you do get the part, you're like, wow. And because you played a lot of roles like Harry in certain aspects, it was a perfect fit for you, right? You know, in your career and different things that you've done. Yeah, okay.
Well, I just sort of felt that.
I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
No. Harry was just a character that was just, you know, it's very easy for people to criticize things like that, because you can't really reinvent the wheels. They say, well, he's a noir cop, you know, listens to jazz, smokes cigarettes, drinks. He's got a quick temper, but, you know, he's divorced. But that sort of that really ultimately does not inform the character as to who he is. You know, the more interesting stuff, and then people kind of would tune in and then would take it back. And certainly the people who are the fans of the books, you know, you don't, God forbid someone be even remotely critical of Harry Bosch. I mean, they literally will hunt that person down. There's an incredible devotion to the books, and now it's kind of, you know, transferred or is shared by the viewers of the show, which is great. There's such goodwill toward the show and goodwill to the character.
Have you read Michael's series before taking on this role? Did you get a chance to read any of the books that Michael wrote about Harry?
I'd only read one book, and that was many, many years prior to reading the script. You know, I did remember that it had resonated, and I made a sort of a note to myself that I wanted to read more of the books, because I'm a big Chandler fan and Higgins and so you know it just was a period. It's just time and space, and I didn't get to read another book. And then I jumped into reading the three books that we used for the first season. I initially had said to Connolly, which books would you recommend that I read in preparing for the role? And he said, you know, the truth is, you can really read the three that we're using for this season. That will give you an insight into Harry but he sent me all the books, and they're a prized possession of mine. I have all of the books, you know, hardcover first edition signed by Connolly. And those are not the ones that I choose to read. I go out and I buy them in paperback, because I'm typically reading them on an airplane or in a, you know, in some sort of exotic holiday location, because that's the only time I can read those books, because I can't, I binge read them because I can't put them down. So that's not my, you know, on my nightstand, because otherwise I tried it one time. I was up at 3 a.m. and realized that I had to get up in 3 hours to get my daughter ready for school.
It's pretty cool reading a book that you're the main character in, right? That's something you probably didn't imagine in your wildest dreams, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And what's interesting for me, because, you know, we don't follow the books.